Welcome to Us with me, Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, where we have critical conversations on the challenges of our time. Come dig in with me and my guests as we tackle critical discussions about the hard lines we draw regarding morality, inequality, and the spirit. Listen while we focus on the intersections of truth and justice as we learn how to coexist, pushing our social transformation to the next level. Let's get ready to be inspired and engage in questions about humanity and believe in a different world. As we look forward to listeners who want to experience media from an intersectional and healing justice perspective, Us with Dr. Crystal Lee starts now. Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, and you're listening to Us on Transformation Talk Radio. Stay with us for the next hour with environmental justice leader Carrie Fulton. Welcome, Carrie. Carrie Fulton is an award-winning environmental and climate justice organizer, writer, and historian. She has worked with various domestic and global coalitions to coordinate campaigns and national conferences, including PowerShift, the largest climate summit in the United States, and the People's Climate March. Fulton has trained and engaged students and communities on climate and environmental justice across the United States and the world. Her work has been featured in various media outlets, including Black Entertainment Television, BET, Teen Vogue, Essence Magazine, and Chinese cable television, CCTV. Fulton is a mother, a bike enthusiast, and a graduate of Howard University. Carrie, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation with me.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be on your show. This is awesome.
Thank you, love. I miss you. And I know, and I've been seeing what you've been doing over the years. I mean, we've known each other well over a decade, like a decade and a half. And I really wanted to bring you on and to show folks all the different ways that you contribute to justice. So let's start with that, right? Can you tell our listeners what you do and how you feel like you contribute to justice?
Well, I am a organizer and an educator around environmental and climate justice. I've been in this sector, in this movement since 2006, 2005, really, because Hurricane Katrina, the winds of Hurricane Katrina and the aftermath of that really opened my eyes to what environmental justice means and how it impacts us. And also what we should be doing to address climate change and how it will disproportionately impact the communities that I live in and the communities that my family lives in and the communities who are already disproportionately impacted by so many other socioeconomic injustices. So that's what I do. And also in general, I think that the most important thing that I say I do is I try and live life as positively as I can, which can be difficult, but every day is a journey in making sure that we are looking at the possibilities and not just the negativities.
I love that, looking at the possibilities. And I do believe and I agree that it can be very difficult. I mean, regardless, even if you're in the work, right? Like, it's just an ethos, a way of being that has always impressed me about you. One of the things that you said right around Hurricane Katrina is something I think that people outside of NOLA, you know, forget the devastation that happened and continues to happen, and how you said it taught you what environmental justice means. So what does environmental justice mean?
So yeah, environmental justice, you know, if you're going from the government definition, has to do with fair and meaningful and equitable treatment for all people, regardless of race, class, gender, economic background, whether you're indigenous, whether you're not, and in making sure that people have access to getting involved in decision-making around our environment, making sure that people are not disproportionately impacted by environmental polluting industries and toxins in our environment. And so climate justice, you might hear that term a lot more now. is a term that is an offshoot of environmental justice in saying, hey, climate change is happening, and we want to make sure that those who are already disproportionately impacted by colonization and by the disparities of what caused the climate crisis we're in right now, that they are not bearing that burden, and that there can be just transition to a clean energy economy and to one that really can save us from the worst of what can happen with climate change. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's so important, like that idea of, you know, climate justice, moving away from environmental justice, but looking at the intersections of how it touches all of our lives and the infrastructure of our lives, right? Like, and how our cities are built, how we use energy, right? And you talked about industry. And in a previous interview that I saw that you gave, you were talking about plastics. And, you know, one of the things you said is that, like, we have to innovate, right? Like, we have to innovate these industries so that they're not negatively impacting the environment and, of course, then us. So when we talk about industries, like, what industries are some of the, you know, hardest hitting polluters?
Well, definitely. There's some major, major different polluters, whether we're talking about, you know, the coal and oil industry, but also we're looking at, of course, the plastics, how we produce plastics. Even when we think about recycling plants, you know, people think recycling is great, which it is. But for those who live near recycling plants, you also have to deal with the toxins that may come out of that processing. So when we talk about what's worse, I'm sure someone has done the data, but it wasn't me. But what I will say is that when you talk about cumulative impact, because that's the real issue right there, you might say, hey, we have this, you know, coal-fired power plant, and that's the one thing that's in our neighborhood. But many neighborhoods have not only a coal-fired power plant, but they also have an incinerator. They also have a trash transfer station. They also have a river that's been polluted by these industries and illegal dumping. You also have public housing that is not being properly maintained by the city. You also have highway infrastructure and the emissions, the diesel emissions that come off of that. And actually, when we talk about, you know, the emissions that come from the vehicles that we drive, that is a major, major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. And it's one of the solutions that we, you know, that we're actively working to transition from. And that's going to be a major process, and it's going to have deep implications, especially as we're talking about more low income, more communities of color being displaced to suburbs and to areas with less public transportation and less access to getting the rebates and the benefits of getting these electric vehicles.
Yeah, it's getting the rebates, getting approved, getting the financing if necessary. And one of the things that I think, you know, that kind of clicked into my head when you're talking, I mean, I think, as you know or remember, I'm from Flint, Michigan, and my city has had many struggles. And right now, with the Flint water settlement, we have until next month to put in, I mean, that you can't pay your way out of this harm. I don't know. What do you think about that? What do you think about the Flint water crisis? I'm curious.
I think the Flint water crisis is a great example of what happens when people are conditioned not to care about other people. When people see greed, when they see finances, when they see capital as gain, and when we divide ourselves, when we tell ourselves that, you know, there's this term that often is used in the early stages of the conservation movement and an environmental movement, not in my backyard, right? Mm-hmm. And people talk a lot about NIMBYism and the idea of, like, well, okay, you don't want it in your backyard, but what about everybody else's? And that was a big issue that happened with the Flint water crisis, is that there were people who did not have to bear the brunt of the political and the health implications of making a decision that impacted so many people. And frankly, they didn't care because they didn't feel like they would get caught, or that it would matter, or that even that the people, the communities that are going to be harmed, would matter. And so even with this slow pace of implementation of infrastructure projects, switch over pipes to make sure that people get the medical resources they need, it's just another example of, you know, people who have been conditioned for centuries, really, to think of another group as less than, will continue to do that. If we do not fight back, if we do not make sure that we're paying attention, if we're not constantly thinking about more than just the bottom line dollar.
I couldn't agree more. And I mean, my whole family is there. And one of the things that really hurt me the most, like, I had friends' parents die. I mean, people, it's not over. People are still suffering from it, right? And I thought about that when I saw the ad for you and Bill McKibben to be talking at the DC Climate Convergence earlier this month, I think. But I was like, oh, I know Carrie has something to say. I know she does. And so the next thing I want to talk about is this climate convergence, but also on how you bring in the voices of directly impacted people into these spaces.
Yeah, for sure. It was definitely an honor to, number one, give a keynote address at my alma mater, Howard University, you know, my undergrad alma mater, and not only to Howard, but to the larger DC University Consortium. So my other alma mater, Georgetown, was also in the building, which I appreciate. But yeah, for discussions like that, one of the things that was important for me, I had a discussion with Bill McKibben, and he was like, look, I'm working on Third Act, which is my new organization. And we're working on engaging, you know, some of the older generation, the boomers who, you know, really want to stay active, but are in a different place generationally. And he was like, maybe you can bring that youth voice. And I laughed because I was like, you know, it's been a while since I've been a youth organizer, honey. So I was like, I will bring my son so we can even out, right? Because everybody wants to, you know, it's funny because people oftentimes will still talk about millennials as though we're youth. And many of us are like, you know, in our 30s and 40s, you know, so I have friends that are grandmas. So when we think about that in that framework, I thought that a lot in the sense of what it means to have discussions and ensure that we are thinking about the various levels of where folk are at and the various levels of how we live, you know. So one of the things I thought was key was to bring in the ancestors as well, because there are so many people who have been a part of this work in so many different ways in their lives. And whether it's, you know, the organizer who passed away from cancer, or the young adult who faced depression and died from a drug overdose, you know, all of these different things, you know, are key and critical. And these are things that are happening within our communities as well. So I wanted to bring that some of the people in my life who are from the communities and the organizing, and even my own family that passed away over these last 2 years. So that was key and critical. And also continuing on that same thread of innovation. Oftentimes, because we have all of these different constraints, you know, financial constraints, the opinions of people who want to reach their bottom line, you know, politics, little things, like is someone at capacity and not able to do the bureaucratic things that are necessary to keep something moving. This all stalls us out from getting to the innovation that we need. And we are so behind. Like the fact that we are just now getting some funding for infrastructure that's so desperately needed is, you know, a key and critical piece of why we are not advancing ourselves for the next 140 years if we are not taking a critical opportunity to think about what is our generation's duty to advance innovation and not just advance it, but fight for it.
Yes, I'm into the fight and I'm into thinking about innovation and ideas and this question around like infrastructure funding and infrastructure in general, right? So I want to see if you're down to like, let's do an innovative intersectional infrastructure idea. Like what would that look like to have an intersectional infrastructure plan, right? For climate change? Like what would you want folks to like focus on and do? What do we need?
Oh man, there's so much that we need. And I think that, you know, I had the opportunity to work with some amazing organizations who are right there thinking through those ideas, you know, who are looking at it and saying, hey, you know, this is what we can do on a local level. This is what we can do on a federal level. This is what we can do on a global level. So I would definitely encourage folk to visit climatejusticealliance.org, which is a great alliance that I have the opportunity to serve with and work on policy with. And every day, you know, I hear another story of one of our 82 member organizations and the cool things that they're doing. I also think when we think about intersectional, oftentimes it's like things get exciting and they sound like they have the potential to be intersectional and we have to push to make sure that it actually is. So one of those is a lot of people have been talking about the Justice 40 initiative, which is a federal strategy to ensure that investments from these climate change and infrastructure projects, that at least 40% of those benefits from investments go to disadvantaged communities. So within that, even that tiny little sentence that I said, there is so much that needs to make sure that we actually get that funding to the ground, to the people who really need it. But it's an interagency approach. And so, you know, when we think about that, we think, hey, these are the necessary baby steps that actually took a lot of work from the federal government to get there. And even though they've announced it and they've started moving on it, the implementation is happening right now. The decision on how it's implemented is happening right now. And so I'm really excited about not just, I mean, oftentimes people are like, federal policy, whatever, it takes too long, you know, it's tiring, it's a setup. But I oftentimes feel like that's what people want you to believe so that you don't fight, you know, give up now, then you won't fight. And I feel like right now is a desperate time. We have a 10-year window, which is really less than that when we talk about what could happen with the extremes of the climate crisis. And it's really an opportunity for all hands on deck to make sure it happens. And it's not just with Justice 40 implementation, but it's in all ways that we can think about moving the needle to get the things that we want.
Most definitely. Yeah. I mean, you talk about this 10-year window. And one of the things I think I was thinking about, like in the past 10 years, the wildfires in California have just decimated the place and they're not getting any better. And then I think about the Midwest and I think about the tornadoes in the southern Midwest. And I think about the flooding that's happening, and I think about the crops not growing, and the use of, you know, has been a continued use of genetically modified foods, and to deal with the climate change, but it's also not good for us. It's gross. Looking at extreme weather, right? Like your website's checktheweather.net, right? So what's some of the things when you're thinking about, if someone was looking at the weather, what could they learn about climate change? What would they be able to see if they were thinking about climate change when they're checking the weather?
Well, I think the biggest part is the misnomer when people call it global warming. So, you know, the IPCC, which is an acronym that there's an International Panel on Climate Change, which is hosted by the United Nations. And they do the research on where we are at with climate change. And it's like, they just came out with their most recent report, and their most recent report in short summary was like, girl, it's looking bad. We need to do something. I mean, y'all are pump faking. That's my general translation and summary. But anywho, but with that, I think it's interesting because the climate deniers, when they want to deny, they always say global warming. And so I even looked at Fox News. I started doing some screenshots of national news coverage of the IPCC report. And so some websites, the more liberal websites like The Guardian, were like, this is where we're headed to, you know, the end, y'all. This is looking bad. The folk need to step up. You know, you had some of the more moderate sites that were like, yeah, it's bad, but you know what? We also need to focus on some climate optimism. We need to focus in on trying to figure out a strategy. And then there was Fox News, and they were like, yeah, but I don't think people are talking enough about the benefits of global warming. You know, and it was just like, oh my God. But so when people think about Check the Weather and what it means, I always want people to know that climate change is a lot like having the flu. Sometimes it might be hot. Sometimes you might have chills. It's, you know, it's not the day-to-day weather changes. It's the long-term, you know, weather changes. It's how our environment around us changes. And then there's also the realities of, you know, not only is our environment changing, but where we live is changing. You know, when we look at the census tracts and the census data that just came out, we're also talking about another great migration that's happening for Black people, you know, from moving from these more urban concentrated areas in cities like New York and LA and moving towards the South, you know, moving to places where it's more affordable. Some cases that's, you know, people moving because they want to find more affordability, which is true. Some cases it's because public housing is also shutting down in a lot of places over the country. So they're transitioning people from public housing to Section 8 vouchers. Mm-hmm. And when you transfer people to Section 8 vouchers, a lot of times what I hear from some of the organizers I work with and some of the people I know who live in public housing is like, they'll say, yeah, girl, you can take this Section 8 voucher anywhere you want to go. Anywhere in the country, you could take it. Oftentimes, what that means is you could take it anywhere but the rich neighborhood you're trying to live in. You know, you could take it anywhere but this neighborhood that we're moving you out of, because these new condo buildings are not going to accept your Section 8 voucher. These new condo buildings are not going to have the number of rooms to fit your family, you know? Mm-hmm. So people are being displaced to more suburban areas, to more areas where you have Republican leadership, which is not to say anything against Republicans, but oftentimes in the policy that we see being pushed forward, it's not as climate forward. You know, it's not talking about green jobs. You know, it's words like, you know, Green New Deal are bad words in many of these places. And it's not discussed in a way that makes sense. So what I worry about when we talk about not only global warming, but also that transition of where people are at in their environments, how it impacts our ability to even take advantage of the clean energy economy that's being built out. Because certain states, oftentimes the states that we're leaving out from, like New York and California, have some of the most progressive climate standards, you know, and are also hosting a lot of the opportunities for job creation, like the increase in offshore wind production. So that's something that people need to look to, not just whether or not they believe that climate change is real, but the economic opportunities and the economic disadvantages that might be ahead of us.
I dig that, because thinking about all the time I spent in California, I lived there for about 11 years, and they were talking about green jobs back in 2009. So, you know, it's not a new thing for some people. For some people, it's completely foreign. And it's this whole different idea. It's like, what's a green job, right? And I think that if folks realize that it's not just even advocacy that they could be a part of when they're trying to work for climate justice, it can be like your job. It can be your career. It can be something that you can innovate, right? And I think opening people's minds to this idea of creation and reimagining our spaces, I think, is super important. Because like you said earlier, folks are moving out one of cities, but they're going to suburbs, they're going to rural areas in places that may hoard this money and may not do that 40, you know, mm-hmm. that's for 40 initiative. So one thing, there's been a lot of like talk and documentaries and reporting on like 2050, right? Mm-hmm. As like a line in the sand. Well, there's been many lines in the sand, but this is like, if we continue on our particular path, the projections for 2050 do not look good. And I think that's part of what you were saying with the IPCC report. But mm-hmm. from your understandings, like with the, what are the kind of projections for 2050? And what does it say the world's going to look like then?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, you know, there's all these projections around what happens if we don't make the necessary infrastructure and mitigation, you know, if we don't do what's necessary to mitigate and decarbonize the world in time to avoid, you know, drastic climate change. There's also the reality that by 2050, that is also, you know, and really by 2040, it's estimated that people of color will be the majority in the United States of America. And so it's interesting to think about these two dynamics being pushed up against each other, because we are fighting not only for representation, for increasing the amount of, you know, not just nominal representation, but truly representative policy and legislation that supports Black, Indigenous, Asian, Latin, Latinx, various communities, marginalized white folk, you know, we're working for the working class right now. At the same time, the people who are pushing back, the people who own these industries, are the people who by 2050 will be the minority. Yeah. So they're making decisions in order to continue to maintain control regardless of their policy numbers. They're making decisions that will impact the next 140 years and even, you know, the next, you know, 25 years. So I always think about that, and I think about that I'll be 65, you know? And my son will be, you know, in his 30s somewhere. And a lot of people are not having kids because they're worried about what the future holds. But what we are fighting for, you know, is for people to not have that as the reality. For people, if they decide that they want to create life, you should have the support systems and you should have the environment that's ready to maintain that and also protect them for the next seven generations, which, you know, estimates to about 140 years.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm definitely one of those people that takes pause on the idea of having children for a number of reasons. Climate justice is one of them, but racism and a number of other things that I'm just like, so I feel you on that. It, you know, where climate justice and reproductive rights can converge. I know I'm not the only one. There's a lot of us out there that either say 100% no, which I'm not there, but like take pause.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have to think about like, what kind of world do we live in where the creation of life is stunted by the conditions we've created?
Yeah.
And some people don't think about it that way. And maybe they should, or consider it, that there's many, many consequences to the world that we've created and allowed to happen in some ways. One of the last questions I have two more for you, is around like this idea of hope and despair that I think we kind of just tapped into, but I know that the work that we do requires a lot of hope and belief in a better tomorrow, or we wouldn't have been in it this long, right? And, but also with that, with the climate crisis, I know, and I have had friends and colleagues who have this deep despair and sometimes depression about not just the state of the world, but like the actual planet. Can you speak to that a little bit? I'm sure you've come across it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was talking to my son and recently, and he was like, oh, I was like, it's Thursday. And he got really sad. And I was like, why are you sad? He said, because that means that there's only one more day of my spring break. And I was like, well, you don't get sad today about tomorrow. You take advantage of today, you know? Like, why are you sitting here being upset and sad because tomorrow is the last day? Take advantage, enjoy, you know? And I think a lot of times we get so bogged down in the future that looks bleak that we don't take an opportunity to appreciate what is right in front of us every single day. And that is really hard at times. Like, I'm not going to sit up here, and I really don't want to give off toxic positivity where it's like, just be happy, just smile, you know, because it's real, you know, and people are dealing with a lot. And I also think that we have not fully addressed what just happened over the last 2 years of our lives. Like, we're not the same people that we were in 2019. We're different people. We're, you know, we're people who may have lost loved ones. We're people who may have gotten in deeper touch with ourselves. We're people who may be dealing with depression that we hadn't realized, but we're also people who have the opportunity to look at what is possible and change it. Oftentimes, we're worried about what's going to happen in 2050. Sometimes I'm in groups and they're strategizing 10 years from now, right? Instead of thinking about what can we fight right now, here and now, today? What type of energy do we need to have? So I was talking with a friend of mine, you know, who's in the funding world. And they were like, well, people want to know how much money, what should they spend their money on? What does, you know, donors want to know? What should be they be focused on? And I told them, I said, y'all should be focused on what it means if we lose. You know, what does it mean if people are so apathetic and so sad about what potentially could be lost? How are we preparing for that loss? What does that look like? How are we supporting our communities? How are we getting in deeper contact with the people who live around us, the people who are really going to matter in an emergency situation, right? And so that climate change in a lot of ways and building resiliency to climate change requires a deeper community connection. Mm-hmm. And it requires a better understanding of it requires a leap into the possibility of thinking that you have the capacity to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about recycling, that's cool, but you can make a phone call. You can ask the questions that are necessary. You might get angry, you know, but you can also turn that anger into action. And I would say that the more that we can get people to do that, the more the people who've been really sad, the more the people who've been fighting for a really long time and are burned out, will see that their work has not been in vain. That, you know, people are seeing it and it's possible. So, and I really think we kind of showcased that as a teaser when we saw all those mutual aid networks popping up during the pandemic. You know, that's just a slight teaser of the potential that we have to come together.
I think that is so key. I mean, these deeper community connections, someone who's lived in multiple places around the country, like my community is the country. And so like, sometimes I'm like, if I'll go to a place and I'm like, okay, we go, this is the network here for this is for that. Right. And I think about like folks, like my family lives in a very small town, a couple thousand people small, and their closest neighbor, they can't see their house. Right? So I don't think they've met their neighbors yet. They've only been there a few months, but I think, you know, there's communities like that. A lot of America is like that.
Mm-hmm.
Where you don't really know who lives next door. And with this continued, unfortunate, divisive political climate, the idea of deeper community connection probably sounds very scary to some people.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than an opportunity to folks like us who are like, people, well, let's figure out how I'm a person and you're a person and let's be people together. Other folks are like, people are scary.
Yeah.
Right? And in some instances, I can't really blame them. Mm-hmm. But I also am like, are they though? And don't we need to do that reframing? Right. And like, because if we can do something, why can't we think other people can change their lives and change the world too?
Exactly. And everything is not about being an extrovert, because, you know, a lot of folk are more introverted. You know, everybody don't want to talk to everybody. And I get that. And I also don't want folk to just, you know, feel like they need a parachute in and then like gung ho. I mean, sometimes it's helpful when, you know, with direct support. But yeah, that would be, to me, I think is critical to think about all the ways that you can that you can learn your neighborhood, you know, and not just, you know, that includes learning the people, but also learning your evacuation routes, learning, you know, where the resources are. And, you know, that's a possibility to share them out. You don't necessarily have to talk to people. You can print them out. Put it on somebody's doorstep.
Most definitely. Go to the grocery store, hand it out. Like,
mm-hmm.
Organizing activity all in itself. I'm so glad we're talking, Carrie. And we should talk again soon. One of the last question I have for you that I know it's going to probably be hard to whittle down to three, but like, what are your top three wishes for change in your work? Like, if there's three things that happened, like, say, by the end of the year, that were game changing for your work, what would they be?
Wow. My three wishes. Oh, that's hard. I would say the first wish would be for more people who have not felt empowered to feel like their voice matters, and that we have a real push for the solutions that are necessary for us to survive, you know. I wish that we can create a world, a country that is ready for and is excited about real innovation, you know, that is looking at this as an opportunity to advance technology. You think about, you know, times in our society where we had huge technological advancements, you know, and what sparked those. And that's something to think about. Sometimes it was war, which is unfortunate, but I would want, you know, and this is, when we say advancement, I don't just mean like, oh, we got a bunch of technology, it was cool. But I really want to see, I want to see folk win. I want to see folk who have been struggling, and I want to see that change. Like, to be able to heal from all of these different traumas is more than a reparations check, you know? So Joe Biden, he said recently, like, oh, I think he said, he was like, I'm not giving reparations, like the indigenous people should get reparations too. I'm like, yeah, girl, you right. But that could mean a lot of things. So really, you know, I really think about it in the sense of like, what is it, you know, people talk about how drastic it was to take down these Confederate soldier statues. But honestly, if we're talking about a 2050 or a 2100 that's truly representative and supportive of the history of the people who truly built this country, a lot of monuments would have to come down, and a lot of other things, a lot of other sources would be celebrated rather than, you know, white men who own slaves. Right. So, and that also requires a change in our economy. So my wish is to truly see the creation of a regenerative economy in my lifetime. So if you ever want to know what a regenerative economy is, there's lots of great research, but also once again, I'll just drop climatejusticealliance.org and you can learn all about regenerative economics.
Awesome, Carrie. Thank you so much. I'm so glad that we got to have this talk. I know we could probably do like 5 episodes together, and maybe we will. In closing, I am just grateful that we got to, one, catch up, two, dive into some of the realness of like people's experiences of climate change and climate justice, because I think that to some folks it's up here, even though they may be experiencing it, they don't know what it is. They don't know what to put the kind of needle on. And so I'm inspired. I learned from you. I'm about to look up this IPCC report. Join us, everyone, next time as we engage in more critical conversations about the issues we collectively face. I'm your host, Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, and thank you, Carrie Fulton.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to us, Critical Conversations on the Challenges of Our Time, with me, Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Together, we bring positive change to the world through critical conversations about social justice issues. Tune in every 4th Wednesday of every month at 3 p.m. Pacific with me, Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, and my guests. For more information about Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, please visit crystalleecrane.org and preventionagenda.org. Happy listening.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.